Judge and Associate Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Paxton. Counsel for the defense, please proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is James Hernandez, and here with Captain John Page, we represent the appellant, Technical Sergeant Kevin Paxton, today. The first argument, appellant was materially prejudiced when trial counsel improperly commented on the sentencing argument about appellant not testifying in sentencing. At sentencing, the defense put on a Lieutenant Colonel Stone, which was a staff clinical psychologist. Lieutenant Colonel Stone testified about the results of a test that he gave Mr. Paxton, Sergeant Paxton. During the questioning and direct and cross-examination, several things were pointed out. Colonel Stone, as a result of the test, opined that Paxton possessed a low risk for reoffending in the future and good treatment potential. He also pointed out that in one of the testing that Paxton was unrealistically virtuous. The government's argument starts in the transcript on page 476, line 13. As cited in our brief, the beginning is page 477, line 15. The portion that we would argue on page 478, lines 2 through 4, the government says he needs severe punishment and long-term treatment to make sure he's never going to do this again. Later on page 478, lines 5 through 8, the government states, we know it is going to take him a while because he won't admit what he has done. He won't admit it to his doctor. He won't admit it to himself. Until he admits it, he can't even get into the treatment. He has to volunteer to get into treatment. Now, what the defense is arguing is that the statement, he won't admit what he has done, is an indirect inference to him pleading not guilty and not testifying either on
the facts. Now, did counsel object?
Pardon me, sir?
Did counsel object?
No, sir. Counsel did not.
So is this a plain error context?
Yes, sir, it is.
And so is it your argument that that's an obvious error?
Yes, sir.
That it's so obvious, even in response to Lieutenant Colonel Stone's, what he had said? Might the prosecution have been picking up on Stone's testimony?
Yes, sir, I would. And I would point that out in that this was not a fair response to Lieutenant Colonel Stone's testimony. I would go to, sir, page 440, lines 4 through 5. Lines 4 and 5. And in this, the question that was asked by trial counsel during cross-examination, they also have to admit that they committed the offense before they can volunteer to get into treatment. Dr. Stone's response was, that I am not sure about. I know they have to volunteer for the treatment. Basically, the counsel's argument, whenever he states they have to admit to get into the treatment, was not a fair response to that answer. For the doctor stated that he was not sure that they had to admit.
And it's your position as well, then, that it is not only not a fair response, but it's obvious and plain that it's not a fair response?
Yes, sir.
Don't you have to take that position?
Yes, sir. This was not a fair response to the doctor's testimony. The trial counsel obviously was trying to get across two theories. He was trying to get across the theory that Mr. Paxton had not admitted to what he had done and that he did not take responsibility for his actions. Now, later on in the argument of trial counsel, or before the argument of trial counsel, at page 478 of the transcript, lines 1 through 3, he states, it also tells you he is unwilling and has an inability to accept responsibility and to disclose personal information. In the doctor's testimony, he stated that Mr. Paxton had an inability to disclose personal information. However, the doctor's testimony did not touch on the inability to accept responsibility directly. The trial counsel basically wanted to get out these two points. The defense would argue that this was an indirect inference to Paxton pleading not guilty, not testifying during findings, and not giving an unsworn or sworn statement during sentencing.
Explain that. Why is that an indirect reference to those issues?
So basically, through the statement, he won't admit what he has done. That is the argument of counsel. He won't take responsibility.
And the testimony of the doctor that indicated that, I don't know if I have it here, that indicated that he was unwilling to accept responsibility and to disclose personal information doesn't bear on that?
Your Honor, I believe the doctor only stated that he was unwilling to disclose personal information. Nowhere in the doctor's testimony did he state that he had an inability to accept responsibility.
Counsel, let's assume for sake of argument that your proposition is correct with respect to the error in this case. How does that demonstrate prejudice?
So the prejudice is demonstrated in the fact that trial counsel asked during sentencing that Mr. Paxton be sentenced to 20 years in confinement. The members came back with a sentence of 26 years. This was a theme of trial counsel's during the sentencing argument that he would not admit to what he had done and would not take responsibility for his actions. And of course, it was clear Sergeant Paxton not testifying and remaining silent. So I would say that the even additional 6 years were prejudice toward the client, sir. So
talk about this in the second issue. My question is, the second issue, does that raise questions that may be inconsistent with the first? And that is particularly item C in the second issue, ineffectiveness with respect to advice to remain silent during sentencing. Given the nature of the sentencing testimony that had already been received, why wasn't that a strategy that could reasonably be advised by counsel in these circumstances?
Sir, as far
let's assume that the trial counsel had not made the argument that he made, but that he made a proper argument based upon the testimony of the testimony of the psychologist. And I'm not suggesting that the argument was improper at this point, just from the accepting your proposition that the argument was improper. Assuming that the trial counsel had not made any of those words at all, but it simply parroted the exact word of the psychologist's testimony, why would it be an unreasonable strategy in these circumstances to advise the accused not to testify during sentencing?
So the unsworn statement or the sworn statement is the first instance at times that the members have a chance to see the appellant as a human being, to be able to gauge his demeanor when he speaks, to be able to listen to his hopes, his dreams, his career aspirations.
Are you suggesting that it's per se IAC if he doesn't give if he's advised not to give one?
So what I'm saying is, in a case of this nature, it needs to be given. A case of this nature in which the members have not heard from the appellant.
You're saying it's per se ineffective assistance if he hasn't testified to advise him as well not to give an unsworn statement.
So what I am saying is that in this case, whenever it has to do with the sexual assault by a father upon a daughter, it is such an emotional case that the members need to have the emotions and need to experience the emotions and the dreams of the appellant as far as his experience. This man had 18 and a half years in the Air Force. He had numerous duty stations in which he was deployed. He had a father that was a retired Air Force who had served three tours in Vietnam. This man had basically oriented himself his entire life through high school toward a military career. It is a chance for the members to hear that. It is a chance for the members to gauge this person whenever they go back and have to weigh his sentence, to consider Sergeant Paxton as a whole individual, as a human being, as an Air Force sergeant, and the good things that he has done as a son, a brother, and also as a father.
Is it fair for us to assume at this point, based on issue one, that had he made a presentation, he would not have admitted to any of the offenses to which he pled not guilty at trial?
If I understand Your Honor's question, if he had made presentation during findings, sir?
No, during sentencing. In other words, during sentencing in this case, if he had made the statement, which you're challenging in issue two, the absence of such a statement, is it fair to assume, based upon the defense presentation on issue one, that this would not have been a case in which the accused would have said to the members, "I feel remorse for these acts," and in effect acknowledged having committed them and asked for mercy on that basis?
I think that would be a fair statement, Your Honor.
And so in that kind of situation where you have an accused who is not going to admit remorse or guilt during the unsworn statement, why, that returns to my earlier question, and you have a psychologist who has testified in a manner that underscores those particular matters, why is it not a reasonable strategy in that point to keep the individual off the stand so that the members would not be asking the implicit question, where are his feelings about the specific acts of which we've just convicted him?
So I would go back to the psychologist's testimony. In part, and where the psychologist stated, Lieutenant Colonel Stone confirmed in his report the appellant as having a preoccupation with feeling guilty and having a lack of initiative and having a makeup that keeps him from reorienting his life, which is page 445. The psychologist with preoccupation with guilt was just the opposite. I believe that it could be argued that he was remorseful, Your Honor.
Last question in this regard. Am I correct in reading your brief that these issues are wholly independent of one another, and that is, if you would prevail on issue one, then issue two is moot at that point, and the presentation of counsel doesn't matter?
No, sir. Basically, issue one goes toward the sentencing. Issue two, the ineffective assistance of counsel, goes toward the findings and the sentence.
Okay.
Which we were asking for relief, Your Honor.
Okay. And which part of issue two are you focusing on the findings?
Your Honor, on issue two, the theory of defense, basically the not calling...
Spouse and former spouse.
Of the former spouse, Lori Morris and Oxana Paxton. And in the appellant's brief, we have provided in Appendix E the leaving only statements of Sergeant Paxton. The defense had at their disposal these leaving only statements. They showed that the child support had been reduced from $1,000 to $500. They showed that this was reflective in the November leaving warning statement. If the former wife would have been called to the stand, she would have testified that she had a strong dislike for Sergeant Paxton, that they went through a bitter divorce, that there was a custody battle, that she had made claims to his command for more support, that she was upset that the child support had been reduced, and that these allegations came after she was informed that the child support would be reduced.
Counsel, isn't this
one last follow-up on that. So then it's just part D of the issue two that's separate from issue one? Failure to call the spouse and the former spouse?
Part D goes to the findings, Your Honor. I would argue that the entire A through D in the aggregate goes to the ineffective assistance of counsel.
No, I understand that, but my question is, with respect to the sentencing, if we were to hold, this hypothetically, if we were to hold in your favor on issue one, then would there be any reason to address issues A through C under issue two, all of which go to sentencing?
So And I would have to say that even though Part D goes to findings, Part D would also go to sentencing, because if a member, even though he did not, would not have a reasonable doubt to find the person not guilty, that still might be in his mind when he goes back for sentencing.
Okay, thank you. And I interrupted Judge Stuckey.
No, I apologize. Isn't the decision not to put on the ex-wife and the present wife the kind of tactical decision that counsel makes all the time, particularly in a trial like this, which we don't second guess.
Your Honor,
they both had, you know, the wife had substantial baggage. The ex-wife was going to, you argue, the ex-wife was going to be bitter against the accused. Isn't that the kind of tactical decision that we don't second guess?
Your Honor, I believe that whenever there's a, that whenever you go into a contested case like this and you have evidence to put on and you have a trial counsel that is as sort of as this, you have to put on the evidence that you have. You have to put on the full evidence that you have.
But aren't you making, isn't that a tactical decision?
Well, no,
you're saying tactically you ought to put on everything you've got. Obviously, defense counsel here, trial defense counsel, felt differently. How do we get into second-guessing that kind of decision?
Your Honor, basically, it is, I believe that there, by not putting on this evidence, it falls below the standard of effective counsel. This evidence was available. Even though the former wife had baggage, the
actually, they said the present wife had baggage, but they both did.
Yes, sir. The trial team could still made several points by putting on the former wife. If the former wife would have went into the items that the trial defense team stated was their concern, then the trial defense team could have basically questioned the former wife if she stated that she had been experienced a marital rape, whether she had reported it, whether she had lived with the client afterwards, whether she had had medical testimony, whether this marital rape occurred, and why did she still allow her daughter to go to Germany to live with my client. In other words, the items that they state that they were afraid of could have been positive items if they would have turned it around, if they were prepared. Also, Ms. Oksana Paxton, who also, as Your Honor pointed out, was subject to cross-examination, but she had testimony that attacked one of the crucial pieces of evidence in this case, and that was the child's diary.
Yeah, but didn't that get in anyway?
Sir. Yes, sir. Pages of the child's diary did get in. However, Ms. Paxton would have testified that she reviewed the child's diary shortly before the child left, that the diary did not mention anything about a sexual assault, that the only negative inference toward the appellant was that he did not spend enough time with the daughter. And even the form of the diary, she would have contradicted. Ms. Paxton would have stated that it was a diary that was fastened together on the sides. The diary pages that were admitted were loose leaf pages. So that would have directly contradicted that was a diary that was that the child had present in Germany, sir. Also, in the ineffective assistance of counsel argument, it is during findings where the trial counsel refers to defense counsel's argument as being repulsive and, I believe, disingenuous. The government states that is not inflammatory in their brief. I cannot think of any two words, disingenuous, which I believe attacks the integrity of counsel, and repulsive, as far as being any more personal and inflammatory. Counsel did not object at that to that argument either. In making that argument, basically these words, I believe, went to inflame the members. And as a result of that, again, I go back to the fact that Mr. Paxton, Sergeant Paxton, was sentenced to 6 years, more than what the trial counsel had even requested, when he was sentenced to 26 years confinement instead of the 20 years that the trial counsel had requested. Also, in the ineffective assistance of counsel argument, I see that my time has expired.
Counsel, you could wrap up briefly, or you'll have opportunity during rebuttal for further comment.
Yes, sir. I would wait to rebuttal, sir, and wrap up.
Thank you. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Efron, honorable members of the court, my name is Captain Jefferson E. McBride, and together with Colonel Gerald R. Bruce, represent the United States government in this matter. The trial counsel did not commit an error in which he spoke to appellant's right to remain silent. Appellant received effective assistance of counsel, and specs 1 and 2 of charge 3 are not multiplicious with charge 1. With regards to issue 1, as appellant pointed out, really what we have here is trial counsel's fair inference from the evidence elicited at trial of appellant's inability to accept responsibility. And the comment made at trial was a fair inference to that. Now, what I have to
say. So the psychologist testified that he provided the accused with a Minnesota multiphasic personality inventory, which he testified was to provide indications of clinical disorders. In the record, does the doctor testify as specifically what questions he asked the accused appellant about the incidents that were charged in this case?
That's not evidence in the record that there were there was not a line by line questioning of
any questions. I see in here that he gave him a test showing his personality traits.
Correct.
Were there any questions? Does this record show that there were any questions asked about the incidents that were charged of which he was convicted?
Not to my knowledge in the record.
Does the record at any point show that the psychologist asked the individual whether he admitted specific acts?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor.
Okay. So, what basis would the trial counsel have for saying that the individual won't admit to his doctor? If the record doesn't show that the doctor asked the question, and the record doesn't show anything about the individual's response, and is simply showing a personality trait, trait is simply an indication of how someone might behave. How do we know either that the doctor asked the question or alternatively that he asked it and the individual answered it in a particular way?
Well, let me, I guess, two things. First, I think it's important to touch on in the record at 444 through 45 that the doctor indicated in his testimony that he blamed others for issues, and that certainly touches on the failure to take responsibility, although it doesn't go directly.
It doesn't show whether someone admits it. An individual can readily admit particular acts and then blame others. It was my mother, my family, my environment, et cetera. We see that all the time.
Well, correct, Your Honor, but I think in light of the standard here, the plain error, that I think in light of that testimony that he blames others, he's unwilling to admit personal things, he's trying to make himself look better, impression management, as the expert tried to say, all those things altogether, I think, fairly encompass what trial counsel said. Is it perfect in the closing and in the sentencing argument? No, it's not. But I think it's certainly a fair inference in regard to the standard this court looks at with plain error.
If the trial counsel wanted to have on the record that he wouldn't admit these acts, that he wouldn't take responsibility for these acts, wasn't it incumbent upon trial counsel to ask those questions to the defense psychologist on cross-examination?
Well, I guess that's problematic in asking the expert to first comment on whether or not, you know, he's going to admit this.
The defense put him on. The defense put the psychologist on. At that point, wasn't it incumbent upon the trial counsel to ask any questions that the trial counsel wanted to ask about the conversations between the psychologist and the appellant in this case?
Well, I certainly think that would help this record, obviously, and that would be a better scenario. But I don't suggest by saying that this scenario doesn't survive scrutiny. I would like the trial counsel to say, hey, did he accept responsibility for these crimes? Did you take that into account in your MMPI, static 99, all those tests? I would like to have seen that. But again, I don't think that undercuts the plain error analysis for this court. So, if there are any questions with regard to issue one, that basically sums up the government's answer to issue one, in that I think it's fairly encompassed within trial counsel's argument under even Edwards' standard, which requires the foundation to be laid, even if this court finds that it's a comment on his right to remain silent. I think we still stand scrutiny under Edwards, and that a foundation was laid here because it's appellant's answers to the expert that was then brought out at trial, although not specifically on to whether he was guilty or innocent of this.
Did he give any answers to the expert, or did he just fill out some blocks on a test?
No, I think it's in the record. The expert said what happened in the beginning is he goes to the Life Skills Center on that day, so he filled out a battery of tests, and then they had a series of, I think, about 9 hours over 3 days or so of back and forth questions and answers. I think that's standard in these kinds of cases.
And at what point in the record does the doctor testify as to the specifics of any of those conversations?
To the very specifics, he doesn't, but he certainly alludes to arriving at those conclusions when he talks about unwilling to disclose personal information, engaged in impression management, and that he shows a lack of initiative and adult autonomy to get the help that he needs whenever he has issues. That, coupled with the blaming others for his issues, certainly, I think, enunciate what was going on during that conversation, although the exact language of the question and answer session was not revealed at court.
Could you speak to the prejudice prong of assuming that people don't agree with you on the first part of the analysis? Can you speak to the issue as to whether there was prejudice on these facts to this accused?
Well, I think that ultimately what we're talking about here is you had taking in context of the entire sentencing argument, you had 7 or 8 pages of trial counsel argument, 12 altogether if you count both of them, only which 4 or 5 lines take up what we're talking about here. So I don't think that there was, it was the nature of this particular issue that found appellant receiving 26 years here. It was the nature of his conduct in general and the overwhelming evidence at trial. So I think that the sentencing argument, as little as it was addressed in this issue, didn't prejudice the appellant in that regard. If there are no other questions with regard to issue one, I'd like to move on to issue two, in that appellant alleges really 4 prongs to ineffective assistance of counsel. And the first one, actually, let me address prong B, which is the failure to object in the sentencing argument, which brings us why we have the plain error analysis. But again, in the end, what you have is counsel's words were comments on, not on the right to remain silent, but on the rehab potential as evidenced from the expert's testimony.
So, well, issue two is based on the assumption, and we recognize the government doesn't agree with it, that there was error in issue one, because it would this, let me, I'd like your view on this proposition, that is, if same proposition I presented to the defense. If the defense wins on issue one, parts A, B, and C of issue two go away. That is, if there's error and prejudice in a plain error sense, you don't get to the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel on sentencing because the sentencing proceeding is gone. On the other hand, if the defense doesn't win on issue one, that is, if we determine either that there was no error or that it wasn't prejudicial, then the defense, it would seem, couldn't win on issue two, A, B, and C, because it couldn't meet the second prong of Strickland.
That's, I think that's a fair assessment of the interplay between issue one and issue two in the sentencing aspects.
So while my colleagues may have some other questions on A, B, and C, I'd suggest, at least from my perspective, to focus issue two on part D, which has to do with the findings.
Well, in light of that response, I will go to prong D. And that is obviously the failure to call Laura Paxton, and which was his ex-wife, and Oksana Paxton, his current wife, at the time. And I think we enunciate this in our brief, but ultimately I think that there was a clear tactical decision here. There's the classic balancing of what am I going to get out of this witness that might work in my favor to present to the members, as opposed to what's going to cut against me. And there were, on both witnesses, issues. With Laura Paxton, you certainly had the issues of her wanting to bring up marital rape and other kinds of issues. That kind of testimony alone could certainly spill over into a bad impression of the court members. And arguably, had defense counsel allowed Laura Paxton to get up and testify and bring up an issue of uncharged misconduct like this, we'd be here probably for the same thing, saying defense counsel should have never put on Laura Paxton, knowing that that was out there. The fact of the matter is that Laura Paxton's information that she didn't like appellant, and suggesting maybe there was some issue with her conspiring with her daughter or her being the one to bring up the these indecent acts and rape, really was brought out under cross-examination with Brett. I mean, I think it was pretty clear in the record that Laura Paxton didn't like the appellant. So I think that in light of this court, gives deference to attorneys when they're making tactical decisions like this, appellant must lose on that issue. With regard to Oksana, same thing. We have an individual, as initiated in the affidavit and in the brief, in Oksana, that was met when he was in Korea. It's a young Russian wife. And this person contributed to giving alcohol to the victim in this case. She had every reason to have a bias to prevent her husband from going to trial. It just simply wasn't worth it to have Oksana get up and say, I found this diary, and the diary didn't mention anything about this. Oh, but by the way, I'm biased in this issue, and I also am kind of at fault here because I also contributed alcohol to this young victim. Those kinds of things show the instability of the family and go directly to helping the trial counsel prove their case. If there are no questions with regard to issue two, I'd like to move on to issue three. In issue three, multiplicity, appellant argues the specification of 1 and 2 is the indecent acts of touching the victim's breasts and touching her vagina was multiplicious or at least unreasonably multiplied with charge 1, which was the rape. Well, I don't think the facts in this case support that. In light of the fact there doesn't appear to be any clear congressional intent, we should move to the elements test as set out by Teeters and Weymouth. And so what we have here is an indecent act that is separate conduct than what you have with the rape.
Does it matter that we have an indecent act with a child under the age of 16 and that it's charged that way, or are those different specifications?
Well, I think that if we're talking about the elements test, it does matter that it's under the age of 16.
And does it matter to distinguish the facts of this case from the Schoolfield case?
I think it does, because the Schoolfield case, I think, is clear, and you even see in the MCM where it shows rape as being the greater offense to an indecent act. It doesn't talk about the indecent act with a child under 16, because that's a wholly separate element in regards to that. Not to mention that in Schoolfield, obviously, as we pointed out in our brief, the force and lack of consent issues were all part of the same sexual contact. That is, we're talking about, was it rape or was it the indecent act? We don't have a series of A, B, C, and D contacts. So in that regard, I think Schoolfield on its facts are distinguishable, not to mention that the elements between the rape and an indecent act with a child are distinguishable in those cases. So if we're looking at the conduct in this case, I think what exemplifies the difference between the indecent act and the rape is the intervening circumstance that occurred between touching the breasts and touching the vagina, and that is the sodomy and the, quote, hand job that she was required to give to the appellant. That incident separated the indecent act and the rape.
Well, can you answer my question, which I guess maybe you're not understanding, which is, you know, why do we have to go to the different things that happened in between the indecent act with the child under the age of 16 and the rape? If we look at the elements of the different offenses, talk about that.
Okay. Well, again, I guess when you're looking at the strict elements test, I think it shows there's one element in the indecent act with a child under 16 that's not required in rape. And so the elements test, I think, gets you there. But then you run into the lesser included offense scenario.
But isn't there at least two elements of the indecent acts with the child under 16 than there is to rape? I mean, there's at least two separate elements that are not found in the rape offense.
Right. Well, I guess you're referring to the force and...
Well, I'm referring to the fact that you can rape someone without an intent to gratify your lust or sexual desires, right?
I'm sorry.
You can rape someone without having the intent to gratify sexual gratification, sexual lust or desires, right?
That is true, Your Honor.
And that's an offense of the indecent act with a child under the age of 16?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And they have to be under 16, and you can rape someone that's over 16?
Obviously you can rape someone over 16.
So I guess based on that discussion that we just have, my question is indecent act with a child under the age of 16 a lesser included offense of the act of rape? Because I wonder why you're saying that.
Well, no, and I appreciate Your Honor pointing that out, the offense of the element of having to show that you did it with the intent to gratify your sexual desires and your lust. And that really is, ultimately, after you do the elements test and you do the lesser included offense, that the elements test, that element alone, I think, then shows that prove that element doesn't necessarily have to prove the other element under Waymouth, then there's not the multiplicity in this case. Because am I still confused about the... So I guess let me try to explain a little better. That element, I think, survives scrutiny here with regards to any of the tests that you apply, whether it's the elements test or looking at the lesser included offense, that whether those elements are necessarily subsumed by the other offense.
So is it the government's position that if an individual rapes a person under the age of 16 with intent to gratify sexual desires, that that's always two offenses? And we're talking about the exact same act in both, no separate acts, no separate time. The act of raping an individual under the age of 16 with intent to satisfy sexual desires, is the government's position that that's always two offenses?
I guess I'm trying to think of a scenario in which, you know, we would have a factual scenario where that would occur, where that would be charged, where you'd have the same, you'd have the rape, and then they'd charge us the same exact rape as...
I'm not talking about the discretionary issue of whether it's likely to happen. I was just trying to follow up on your responses to Judge Ryan's questions.
I guess in a factual scenario like that, it would be hard to say that it wouldn't be multiplicious if you're charging both rapes as you're charging one rape without intent and the other rape with intent to gratify. Is that what you're asking me? That in,
well,
that scenario,
in the rape, my understanding of your answer to Judge Ryan is that in rape, the intent to gratify sexual desires is not an element of the offense.
Correct.
So my question, in light of your response to her, is that does that then provide the government with the opportunity to charge two separate offenses growing out of the exact same act? The individual is questioned afterwards and admits, or there's evidence that he said to somebody, "I did this to gratify my sexual desires." Probably wouldn't say it in the legal terms, but the evidence would establish that. So now the government charges the individual with rape, and the government charges the individual with the indecent act. And my question is it the government's position that those are two separate offenses, or is there a multiplicity problem when that happens?
Well, the government's answer has to be that there's not a multiplicity problem there with regards to than double jeopardy anyway, potentially with unreasonable application of charges. But to say otherwise would mean then that element is not, to say the intent to gratify your sexual desires would then be a subset of rape somehow. And I don't think that's set up that way in the punitive article itself. So I would say you could charge both of those, same act, and then maybe have an unreasonable multiplication of charges problem, but not one rooted in double jeopardy, for example.
Yeah, I think I understand the government's position. Thank you.
Is there an unreasonable multiplication problem here? Aren't these all one course of conduct in a fairly restricted time period?
Well, I guess the government's contention is really not, and I really point to the intervening circumstance that I pointed out earlier, which was the sodomy and the hand job incident, quote unquote hand job incident in the record, between that and the rape, and the fact that she said no to the sexual intercourse, and in the other incident said yes to having her breasts touched, and arguably also to the having her vagina touched. So I think these are, while they're enclosed in a fairly narrow time frame, I think these incidents represent separate courses of conduct for purposes of unreasonable multiplication of charges. Really, if you look at the five prongs established by this court, that the first prong is the only prong that appellant really meets successfully, and that is that they objected at trial under this theory. That in each of the other prongs, that the specifications aimed at distinctly separate criminal acts, I think that's established here by the touching of the breasts and the vagina under different circumstances than doing the rape under her protest. And then that the number of charges and specifications don't misrepresent or exaggerate his criminality. I mean, I think it's a wholly separate issue to do, again, the breast touching and the vagina touching as opposed to the rape. And then combining the last two, there certainly wasn't an unreasonable increase in appellant's punitive exposure because the ultimate maximum punishment here remains the same as life without the possibility of parole, and there's no evidence of prosecutorial overreaching. So I think that the appellant fails on all four of the five prongs set under Quarez, as established by this court. So in the end, the government is requesting that this court find that trial counsel did not comment improperly in closing argument, that there were not ineffective assistance of counsel on any of the prong, any of the A, B, C, or D, as alleged by the appellant, and that the specifications 1 and 2 of charge 3 are not multiplicious with charge 1. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
I would speak to the second argument, issue D. Basically, it is defensive position that this failed to know standards of counsel. And the fact that the defense had at their disposal a theory of defense, a theory of defense that could have been explained within the first two sentences in opening statement, a theory of defense that went directly on point, that of the withdrawal of financial resources, that could have went directly on point, and they could have given that to the members at the very beginning and opening. By doing that, by failing to put on that, they missed a viable, very viable theory of defense. The most damning piece of evidence in this case was that of the diary. Donna Paxton spoke directly to that piece of evidence. By failing to put her on, they failed to challenge that piece of evidence that allegedly corroborated the child. The defense had at their disposal Ms. Lori Morris, they had at their disposal Oxana Paxson, they had at their disposal the LESs, leaving in earnings statements. Every witness that takes the stand is subject to impeachment. Every witness that takes the stand can be impeached. What you have to look for is the evidence, and this evidence was vital. This evidence was extremely vital to the defense, but yet it was overlooked. The impeachment, even if there is impeachment of the witness, it can still be turned to your favor, an argument. Sometimes the fact of the Ms. Paxton in the trial defense's affidavit to being a barmaid or a juicy girl, as they stated, that would not have sat well with the members. I do not believe that they would have held that against Ms. Paxton as far as merely an occupation. Our members at court martials are officer members, sometimes senior enlisted members. They are educated. That would not be a viable contention for impeachment. The defense basically in their opening statement did not, which is I believe at page 152, did not put forth a clear strategy. In a case of this nature, a clear strategy has to be put forward. They had at their disposal that strategy, but yet failed to act on it. In the multiplicity argument, it's cited, I believe, in Schofield that indecent acts of a child, or indecent acts, I don't believe that was of a child under 16, but indecent acts is a lesser included offense of rape. Of course, in that, it went on to the consent issue. Would argue that the indecent acts were multiplicious for sentencing with a rape and was an unreasonable multiplicious unreasonably multiplicious, they charged by the trial counsel. The punitive action, even though it did not increase the punishment due to rape having a life exposure, it gave Mr. Paxson two additional felony convictions, which is in and of itself punitive. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 10 o'clock this morning.
We'll now hear United States against Thomas. It's a 15-minute per side case. Counsel for the defense.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Lieutenant Anthony Yim, and I represent the appellant, Seaman Recruit Antoine Thomas, United States Navy. With this court's permission, I'd like to respectfully request 4 minutes of time for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. The facts are not in dispute. Appellant had absolutely no idea he was entering a military installation. Appellant was driving westbound on Military Road. He had an opportunity to enter what was later identified as Fort Lewis Army Base. He instead chose to take Military Road, and then it eventually became Perimeter Road. And on Perimeter Road, he was pulled over by the military police. When he was pulled over and during provency, he admits that he had absolutely no idea that Perimeter Road was actually military territory. In fact, Perimeter Road is a public road that connects two different highways. There's no indication on Perimeter Road that it is actually part of the military facility. The lower court, however, decided to eliminate the mens rea of the lower court decided to eliminate the mens rea of wrongful introduction from Article 112 Alpha. Lower court.
Does Article 112 Alpha have a mens rea with respect to knowledge of being on a military base?
No, I know. It argues that it does. We take a look at.
Does it say that in the statute?
It says wrongfully, Your Honor. It does not say mens rea, it says wrongfully. This court has interpreted that word wrongfully to mean to have a mens rea requirement. If we take a look at United States versus Mance, we see the words wrongfully possessed. And this court has held that there was a knowledge requirement. We take a look at United States versus Crumley, where it's wrongfully distributed. We see that that word wrongfully also has a mens rea requirement.
You're not arguing that the accused here didn't know that he had drugs, right?
No, Your Honor.
Or that he didn't know that he had drugs, that they were drugs.
We're conceding the fact that they were drugs, Your Honor.
So he had drugs in a wrongful manner.
Yes, Your Honor. He wrongfully possessed them. However, the statute requires a wrongful introduction.
How many elements to the statute? Is there more than one element to the statute?
No, Your Honor. I mean, the elements are that he possessed, that he introduced it, that it was wrongful, and then the third element is that it's prejudicial, whatever.
Is it your argument that every element within that, therefore, carries the same mens rea?
No, Your Honor. It's our argument that it carries a different mens rea. It's mens rea specific to the crime. We see the federal statute, when they use the word wrongfully, they're applied to, I believe, introduction, possession, distribution, and so forth.
How do you address the public welfare offense line of cases?
If Your Honor, if you could elaborate.
Like Staples and Balint. You're not familiar with this line of case?
I don't believe they were cited by the government, Your Honor.
Balint, for example, which I can't remember, dates to the 20s or something, it's a Chief Justice Taft case, deals with a Narcotics Act, coca and opium. And the concept is there are certain kinds of offenses. I'm not sure how to do this if you're not familiar with the line of cases, because I don't want to do your arguing. I want you to do. I like to ask the questions. You're supposed to do the arguing.
Your Honor, I can address the lower court's logic of applying a strict liability analysis. We see that the lower court instead chose.
In Staples, the court was looking at whether someone. You can characterize it your own way, but was looking at whether someone should be on notice that there's a rigorous regime, regulatory regime, including punitive sanction, for possessing certain items. And their part of the debate was whether guns were more like grenades or food stamps, and you can reach your own conclusion on that and read the case. But the notion was, going all the way back to the Balint case, that there were certain things that were inherently dangerous, or that were inherently bad, and you can fill in your own word later, that the person who had them should be on notice that they were going to be subject to a strict regime, and the courts are very careful not to use strict liability. They don't like that. But that when you're driving around with, in the case of the Narcotics Act, if you're running around coca, then you assume the responsibility of knowing where and when you're permitted to have it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and then there's arguments on both sides, though. If you read those cases, there's arguments that might help your position, the arguments that might not. And I'm trying to figure out where you think you sit on that
Well, Your Honor, we see in the manual, much analogous to those cases as you just described, we see that there are certain, as we call, strict regime or strict liability provisions within Article 112 Alpha. We see that there's no intent requirement when it possesses narcotics on a missile facility or on a vessel, because there are specific aggregators listed in 112 Alpha. However, appellant argues that when Congress writes the statute article with a 10 U.S.C. 912 Alpha, when they included the word wrongfully introduced, they meant to have a specific mens rea of actually introducing it into the facility. If Congress and the President wish to create a scheme in which they wish to increase the punitive nature of narcotics, they could simply have created an aggravator statute with wrongful possession and including the aggravator introduction onto a military facility. However, they specifically didn't do that. Instead, we have wrongful introduction. That wrongfulness in the statute has been interpreted by this court on the other two offenses previously cited by the appellant as having a mens rea requirement. It would be a merit for this court to suddenly decide that wrongful introduction would not have a mens rea requirement, but wrongful distribution and wrongful possession to have a knowledge requirement.
Counsel, you earlier suggested there were three elements to the offense. My recollection is that the offense in this case was charged under 112, not under 134. So,
yes, Your Honor, I
so there was, or then there's no requirement in this case to prove either prejudice to discipline or service discrediting conduct.
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, I recalled an error. In fact,
then if we look at the manual. The manual in paragraph 5 of section C, describing wrongfulness, says that possession, use, distribution, introduction, manufacture of a controlled substance is wrongful if it is without legal justification or authorization. So here, was there any legal justification or authorization for the introduction?
No, Your Honor. I don't think there was not.
So is the manual not a proper implementation of the statutory offense?
The manual is a proper implementation, but by no means is it limiting. The very fact that the manual fails to include an intent requirement under wrongfulness has not prevented this court from reading a wrongfulness requirement in Mance or in Crumley when describing distribution. The manual itself has been shown, and although not cited in Appellant's brief, I believe this court has stated, I believe in United States versus Chechen, when it was dealing with the exculpatory no doctrine, that such provisions would actually, if they're in conflict with this court's case law, shall be overruled. It is the manual that adopts the case law, that the tail does not wag the dog. Though, again, if we just look at the federal statute that Congress passed, we see the same word wrongfully being applied to all four offenses. Two of the offenses this court has defined as having a knowledge requirement.
Does your criticism of the lower court's analysis or analogy to 21 U.S.C. 860 turn on your assertion that it's somehow an aggravator rather than a separate offense?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if you're wrong about that, if you were wrong about that, would your view of the lower court's opinion be different?
Sure, it's probably different, but I believe we would still ask this court for relief. I mean, the lower court is analyzing a statute that has no bearing on this case. The only statute that is relevant to this case is obviously 10 U.S.C. 912 Alpha. If that word wrongfully does not include a mens rea requirement, it would seem to go against this court's prior history in interpreting that statute. And while the lower courts have put forth an analysis, the fact that we respectfully disagree with that analysis is kind of moot in the fact that the real question is how this court will interpret the federal statute put before this court.
Counsel, I don't recall, was Mance a guilty plea case? Was Mance a guilty plea case?
No, I don't recall.
Well, does that make a difference in light of the burdens that were set forth in the manual? That is, what case stands for the proposition that the military judge must inquire as to whether the accused has information that would rebut the presumption of wrongfulness?
Under United States versus, appellant can only cite United States versus Care, which set forth the military judge's obligation to ensure that appellant is actually guilty of the elements set forth within the within the crime. Here we see that the military judge fully is aware of the fact that appellant had absolutely no idea of the fact that appellant was absolutely no idea that he was entering military jurisdiction, yet the military judge still accepted the plea of wrongful introduction, and the lower court, in fact, decides to eliminate the mens rea requirement altogether. So, military judge...
Well, you keep on saying eliminate the mens rea requirement altogether, but you don't disagree that he had to know he had drugs.
Your Honor,
so there is a mens rea requirement.
Yes, Your Honor. When I mean eliminate the mens rea requirement of introduction, it's clear the appellant stipulates that he had the mens rea of possession. But there is no indication that he actually had the mens rea of introduction. And it seems, again, it depends on what Congressman, the actions that Congressman to punish. My understanding via analogy is the fact that I believe Route 1, which is a local road around the city, actually traverses Fort Belvoir. Was it really Congress's intention if a military member is stopped on Route 1, which actually has no indication that it goes through military jurisdiction? Was it Congress's idea to punish those types of service members for wrongful introduction? If it was, upon our views, there are clearly aggravator statutes within the manual for court-martial. I see my time has expired. Thank you.
You'll have an opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
May it please the court, I'm Lieutenant Jessica Hudson on behalf of the government. The appellant in this case knew he was in possession of marijuana. He knew the contraband nature of the substance, and he drove down the road under the control of Fort Lewis. Under Article 112 Alpha, the knowledge required for wrongful introduction is that the appellant knew he had a contraband substance. An introduction must only be wrongful, and appellant's actions in this case were wrongful.
Counsel, if as the appellate defense counsel has stated, for other crimes in 112A, for instance, possession or use, we have interpreted wrongful to require a mens rea requirement, why would not we require one for wrongful introduction?
Yes, Your Honor, and there is still a mens rea requirement as part of the wrongful element to wrongful introduction.
So, but it's wrongful for possession, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. He must know the...
So let's move on and talk about the actual introduction element. Why would not there be a mens rea required for that?
Well, Your Honor, it's the government's position that the wrongful introduction is made a separate crime than possession or use for a reason, and that is to protect the integrity of our military installations, and that there's a purpose behind that being a separate offense.
Go ahead.
If the statute is unclear or uncertain, is there a presumption as to whether there will be a mens rea requirement or not?
Well, Your Honor, I would argue in this case that there's...
Is there a general rule, for example, that a otherwise silent statute is a dog, a cat, or a mouse?
Yes, Your Honor. And normally, if it is silent, it is presumed not to have... presumed to have a mens rea.
Okay, and what do you make of the CCA's paragraph that states, in the absence of specific guidance in the UCMJ and the manual, as well as a lack of case law on the issue before us, we adopt a similar strict liability approach to the offense. Can you discuss that paragraph and its legal validity? So is it up to the CCA then to adopt the mens rea requirement for the statute in the absence of its view guidance in the UCMJ?
Your Honor, you mean the mens rea required in the federal statute, which what they talked about
sure.
beforehand? Well, I believe the lower court was just simply using that as some sort of guidance and analogy in trying to come up with a reason behind the separate offense of wrongful introduction, and analogizing it as in there's a reason for keeping drugs out of school zones, much as there's a reason for keeping drugs off of military installations.
Do you have comment on the public welfare offense concept? Are you prepared to discuss that today?
I'm not. Is that what you cited to in Staples?
Right. Okay.
Counsel, are you familiar with the Gosselin case?
I know I've read it.
It was a 2006 case, 62 MJ 349. And in that case, Gosselin was a passenger in a car that contained drugs. and it was driven onto a military installation. The government argued that Goslin had a duty to interfere with the jurisdiction, or with the introduction, and his failure to do that could be construed as aiding or encouraging the introduction. And this court disagreed with that and found that his inaction didn't meet the accomplice requirements, the accomplice criteria. Doesn't that indicate that in that case we assumed that there was a mens rea element in introduction?
Yes, Your Honor, and I'm trying to remember the facts of the case, whether or not he knew that there was...
He knew there was drugs in the car.
In the car, and he was unaware that he was going on to a...
He went through the gate.
And in an aiding and abetting situation, that is going to indicate that it would not be a strict liability offense.
Thank you.
Counsel, let's focus specifically on the words in the manual. Paragraph 4, wrongful introduction of a controlled substance, has two elements. The first is that it was introduced, the controlled substance, and the second is that the introduction was wrongful. If the CCA were correct that this is a strict liability offense, then it would only, that would seem to be inconsistent with the structure of the manual, because the manual appears to say that it's not a strict liability offense, that it's not enough to introduce the controlled substance onto the installation. The government also has to prove that it's wrongful.
Yes, Your Honor. The government agrees. There's still a mistake of fact offense as to the wrongful element of wrongful introduction.
Then the next part of the manual, in the definition of wrongfulness, says the burden of going forward with evidence with respect to any exception, that is the inference of wrongfulness, is on the party claiming the benefit. So if, let's say we have a contested case, if the party introduces evidence of the road itself, without taking judicial notice of anything here, let's just assume a case of a road that passes from civilian to military, back to civilian, back to military. We all know there are roads of that nature with absolutely no indication that you're on a military installation at a particular point. If that were the case, isn't the burden then on the government to demonstrate something about wrongfulness?
Well, Your Honor, the government's position is that the burden on the government is still just to prove that the appellant knew the presence and the character of the substance that he was in possession of.
Why wouldn't that be a strict liability offense under 4A then? Because 4A, the government could prove that the accused introduced it onto an installation. They could show the coordinates of where it was, and that it was a controlled substance. So if that's all the government had to prove, you'd never get to element B, that the introduction was wrongful.
Well, Your Honor, you'd only get to that if for some reason the appellant claimed mistake of fact.
Would you still have to go to the second element? Would you need to show that they knew that they were in possession, that they had the controlled substance, and that they didn't have a legal justification or excuse?
Yes, ma'am. You still need to show that, and that could be done through circumstantial evidence as well. In this case, was a guilty plea, so it was a different sort of circumstances. But in a contested case, you would still have to prove the wrongfulness. But you could infer wrongfulness from possession.
And when an accused says, I had no idea I was on a military installation, why doesn't that raise an issue for the military judge as to whether there's evidence that rebuts the inference of wrongfulness?
Your Honor, because under the plain language of 112 alpha, the only thing required is that he knew the introduction was wrongful, and that he knew the contraband nature of the substance, which in the Providence inquiry was quite clear.
And he knew the introduction was wrongful. But if he doesn't know he's introducing, how does he know that it's wrongful, that the introduction is wrongful?
Your Honor, he simply runs the risk of driving around with drugs in his car, of being on a military installation. There's no possibility of criminalizing innocent activity here.
The question here is not whether we're criminalizing or decriminalizing, but what the offense is. And the issue is, as I see it raised in this case, is not whether the government is precluded from convicting someone who happens to be on a military installation by relying on the inference, but what happens when the individual introduces information that brings the inference into question. So we have a contested case, and the individual says, I had no idea that I was on a military installation. Is the individual entitled to rely on that at that point and have the members decide whether that's sufficient to rebut the inference?
No, Your Honor, it does not matter. There's no mens rea requirement for him actually knowing he's on a military installation.
So that's not sufficient to raise a question about the inference then? And what case stands for that proposition, that the inference of wrongfulness of introduction cannot be rebutted by demonstrating the individual didn't know they were on the installation?
Your Honor, as far as the government's aware, there's no case law out there. This is an issue of first impression, and I believe that's why the lower court went to Title 21 of the USC. And also, Section 952 Alpha makes it unlawful to import drugs into the United States. It's also a strict liability offense. You don't need to know whether or not you crossed over into the United States to be convicted of wrongful importation.
Would it be a defense to wrongful introduction if you didn't know you were going out to a military base, but you were doing it for some sort of a law enforcement purpose?
Yes, ma'am. That would fall under the wrongfulness.
So then you would have introduced it, but it would not be wrongful.
It would not be wrongful.
Because you would have negated that element. Have you looked at the 21 U.S.C. 860 cases that the lower court analogized to?
I have.
Am I correct that the 860 statute, that the 840 and 841 cases there, I'm sorry, statutory violations there are less included offenses of the 860 violation, correct?
They are, yes, ma'am.
And in those cases, do the circuit courts find that you don't need to know that you're within 1,000 feet of a school?
That is what seven circuits have held. You don't need to know if you're distributing drugs if you're within 1,000 feet of school. Now, in those cases, it is an aggravator to 845 if you distribute. So it's an aggravator versus, in this case.
Well, it's actually a separate offense.
Yeah. I'm sorry, what?
I said it's actually a separate offense. A violation of 21 U.S.C. 860 is a separate offense that has a higher sentence.
Yes, ma'am.
Counsel, in the Drug-Free School Act cases, there's quite a bit of legislative history and language on that. Do we have similar history as to when you make the analogy to this particular offense?
We didn't. Not that the government's aware of, Your Honor. The legislative history of the School Zone Acts do talk about sending a signal that drugs won't be tolerated near school zones.
What's the specific language of that statute? Does it talk about introduction into a school zone or possession in a school zone?
No, Your Honor. I believe it just talks about distributing drugs, distributing, manufacturing, or distributing with the intent, or introducing with the intent to distribute.
Introducing, that's the federal statute, introducing with intent to distribute. Yeah.
The plain language of Article 112 Alpha only requires an introduction to wrongful. An appellant knew, in this case, the contraband nature of the controlled substance he was carrying. It is sufficient that the appellant knowingly possessed the contraband because nothing in the offense of wrongful introduction makes knowledge a requirement. Therefore, the only mens rea required under wrongful introduction was satisfied. The government requests this court uphold the findings and sentence of the court below. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. this Court's well aware of its language in United States versus Clomley, where it said that it would be anomalous to hold that the knowledge was an element of the lesser included offense of possession, but not of the greater offense of distribution. We see that the manual specifically has provisions such that to punish the dangerousness of drugs. So if an appellant was convicted of possession and had no legal justification, we see that he is now required to know that he's on a military confinement facility, on a vessel or on a military launch facility. That's the type of outline that we have in the manual. However, the manual does not indicate that introduction onto a military facility should be viewed under the same type of guidelines. In fact, we see from this Court's interpretation of the statute that there is a mandatory requirement.
Do you agree with the government's position that the offense in civilian life of the possession within the school's zone is an introduction offense, or is it a possession offense?
Your Honor, from my understanding, it was a... I can't recall.
Okay, I do recall
from reviewing my brief that I did find that it was the Appellate Defense Counsel's interpretation of that statute that within 1,000 feet was an aggravator, and that the lower courts did require the mens rea of possession in order to be convicted of the underlying offense. However, obviously, this seems to be in conflict with this Court's. Your Honor, there's, again, the appellant merely relies on the statute of 10 U.S.C. 912 alpha. We see that clearly that the word wrongfulness as applied was meant in the introduction. And absent no other questions from this Court, this concludes the appellant's argument. The appellant respectfully requests that this Court reverse the lower court's decision and set aside the appellant's conviction of the introduction and merely affirm the lesser included offense of possession. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes the argument, and we thank both parties for the presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the Court will stand in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.